welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are going to be talking a little bit about the so-called deep state, if you will, and then we're also going to be having a good conversation here about some of the politics, social issues, and economic issues arising out of the upcoming anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb by the United States. But before we can move on, yesterday, the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, announced that the Justice Department is going to be continuing with initiatives begun under the last administration to develop more stringent guidelines over how forensic science is used in criminal court proceedings. The Justice Department will also look at the needs and challenges facing forensic laboratories around the nation. While this didn't get the huge media coverage that, say, Anthony Scaramucci's meaningless rant did, it's an extraordinarily important development. Attorney General Jeff Sessions had originally discontinued the effort started in 2013 around this, and restarting them is a recognition of major flaws in the U.S. criminal justice system. The immediate precipitating event for the government to even be looking into this was the major scandal at the FBI Forensics Lab, a 2015 review of lab examiners' criminal testimony dating back to the year 2000 found problems in 90% of their testimonies. In particular, FBI agents had been exaggerating how much you could really tell from hair evidence to make cases. In 90% of them, it looks like where the cases where mistakes were found, or nine of the cases where mistakes were found, the people had actually already been executed for the alleged crime that they were charged with. Like 33 are on death row still. However, recent scientific inquiry has cast doubt on what we are often told is ironclad science behind a lot of these methods. Hair follicle analysis at the microscopic level, it turns out, is actually not purely objective, and subsequent DNA testing of hairs in some cases have led to total reversals of verdicts because a hair jurors were told was a match was not. And even DNA, not infallible. For instance, in 2010, New Science magazine took the DNA evidence from a Georgia gang rape case and presented it to 17 independent experts. At the trial, the prosecution had used DNA evidence to state that the man who was ultimately convicted could not be excluded from being present. That is, saying his DNA was there, i.e., he was guilty. However, the 17 independent experts came to a different conclusion. Four analysts said the evidence was inconclusive, and 12 said he could be excluded, i.e., was not there, was not guilty. This, of course, does not mean that this sort of evidence is worthless, just that a standalone statement of guilt or innocence type of situations, forensic science can easily be abused. As the U.S. Academy of Sciences stated in a report on this in 2009, quote, testimony based on faulty forensic science analyses may have contributed to the wrongful conviction of innocent people. In a number of disciplines, forensic science professionals have yet to establish either the validity of their approach or the accuracy of their conclusions. And on top of that, it's become clear that the possibility for wide-scale fraud is also there. And most notably in that situation, we know we have the case of Annie Dukin from Massachusetts, the crime lab in Massachusetts. She actually did 3 years in jail, just got out recently, after revelation surfaced in 2012 that over 40,000 cases were tainted when she deliberately lied and tampered with drug evidence. Now, while authorities in Massachusetts, where this fraud was happening, tried to say it was just one rogue person, it was fairly clear when you read what was going on there that she was playing into an organizational culture that valued convictions over integrity, and no one much cared to look into how the convictions were coming, and especially with forensic evidence, they often seemed ironclad. And now tens of thousands of people could have their convictions overturned. And further, when we discuss this issue, we also have to mention the criminal backlog of rape kits in this country. Routinely, police departments have a, at best, nonchalant attitude towards sexual assault cases, and a huge number of rape kits go untested. According to the In the Backlog campaign, to date, over 175,000 untested rape kits have been uncovered, and just over 30,000, I believe, have now been tested because of their efforts. So shout out to the Backlog campaign. All around, U.S. forensic science is in a state of flux, its methods questioned, and its practices seemingly subjective. But don't worry, plenty of people will still be convicted on this sort of shoddy evidence before the Justice Department finally weighs in. For roughly 4 hours yesterday, a portion of Arkansas's maximum security Tucker Unit prison was under the control of the inmates. They took the keys from a guard and took several guards hostage briefly before the situation was resolved and the guards were released unharmed. There is, as of yet, no real indication of what the demands of the prisoners may have been, but this incident does follow one a few weeks back where prison guards fired warning shots at prisoners in response to a disturbance that was allegedly related to a stabbing. So something going on in this prison. We do know, however, that a number of prison uprisings of late from Alabama to Delaware center around the poor conditions for prisoners, particularly medical care, and the lack of meaningful educational and work opportunities. In fact, despite it receiving little unified coverage since 2008's Georgia prison strike, there have been significant protest activity in America's prisons across the country on these issues and others. Clearly, the system of mass incarceration has not resulted in any real decrease in crime, and its accumulated contradictions were once again on display in Arkansas yesterday. Kern County, California, that's where Bakersfield is, District Attorney Lisa Green announced that she is dropping all charges against Tatiana Green, I believe it was, who was brutally arrested by Bakersfield police in what was a case of mistaken identity on June 18th. You may have heard the story then. It's really pretty unbelievable if you didn't hear the story. The Bakersfield police were looking for a 5'10", 170-pound bald black man with a goatee. Tatiana Hargrove was her name. I apologize. Now, and she is 5'2", 115 pounds, and of course, a black woman, not a 170-pound bald black man with a goatee. Nevertheless, they thought she was this man and stopped her while she was taking a break from riding her bike and drinking water. Now, they demanded to search her bag, which she refused. The police then proceeded to punch and kick her, pin her to the ground, and then let a police dog attack her. Yes, they sicked a dog on her. The police shockingly claimed that they thought she was this man and they just got confused. That's what they wrote on their thing. They were confused. Clearly, that was a transparent lie, though, and hence the dropping of the charges. Of course, no criminal charges have yet been brought against those officers. In a disturbing report that came out in The Intercept recently, it appears Chicago police are turning SWAT teams into their response unit of choice for mental health crises. In the 4 months after Trump's election, the SWAT team was used 10 times in response to suicide threats or attempts. 2017 appears to be on track to see twice as many SWAT raids in mental health situations than the previous four-year average. The incidents are often logged in the police reports as terrorist incidents or hostage situations. In 2016, The Guardian noted that 20% of all police murders involved people having mental health episodes, and around 80 were cases of self-harm. And around the country, there's been a great uproar over the inability of police to develop ways to deal with people in mental health distress without killing them. In many departments, specialized non-police response units have actually been developed to address this. Yet, in many cases, this mainly has resulted in uneven approaches as opposed to curtailing the overall problem. Nevertheless, in Chicago, it appears they aren't thinking too much about any of that. The crisis of mental health care in prisons and the relationship between mental health crises and police murder have drawn attention to the extreme lack of mental health services in this country overall. So, you might not be surprised to know that Chicago just recently shuttered half of its 12 mental health clinics at the behest of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who also chose to privatize the other six. Just noting, he is a Democrat. This also raises the broader issue of the intense militarization of police. SWAT teams were developed principally to suppress radical political groups like the Black Panthers. Since then, they really haven't found their footing. They do use huge amounts of money and buy very expensive weapons to help create the illusion that the police are out here protecting us against some big bad menace. The reality is, though, they don't really have much to do at all, which is why when the ACLU did a deep dive on this in 2014, they found that 79% of all SWAT callouts are just to execute search warrants, and 60% of those are for drugs. Ultimately, it's just the militarization of routine police activity because what else are they going to do with these highly trained and very expensive units? Police militarization in this country is out of control, and this story from Chicago is just another example. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And as we slightly shift gears here, we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Lillian Daigle, who's a deputy campaign director at Global Zero, and David Swanson, who's an author, activist, journalist, and radio host, as well as the director of worldbeyondwar.org. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Lily, I'll start with you. We are fast approaching here the anniversary of the Nagasaki bombing on August 9th, 1945, I believe the 72nd year. We just passed the anniversary, August 6th, of the Hiroshima bombing. So again, the 72nd year of, well, we're not celebrating, marking, I guess, the dropping of the atomic bomb by the United States of America on Japan at the end of World War II. You work with Global Zero. What you guys do is try to reduce nuclear weapons. I think get to no nuclear weapons anywhere. Here we are, 72 years in. Where do we stand?
That's a good question. Compared to where we were at the height of the Cold War, we've significantly reduced the global nuclear stockpile. But there are still 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, many of which are hundreds of times more powerful than the ones that leveled Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing nearly 200,000 people. So the U.S. is on the verge, and actually in the beginning of modernizing its nuclear arsenal. North Korea is developing an ICBM, Russia also modernizing. So the state of nuclear affairs is not promising right now.
David Swanson, your thoughts here on the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, two bombs. Well, I agree that it's good that, the quantity has been reduced so that you could only destroy the planet a certain number of times and not more. But, once would just about do it for me. And, there are now more countries that have got the things. They've been normalized. They've been neglected. We're going to have, a disaster by accident if more care isn't taken. Some friends of mine just went over to Germany and cut a fence and went and climbed on top of a nuclear bunker full of U.S. bombs, and if they hadn't intentionally made a lot of noise, they'd still be sitting there unnoticed, as some other activists had done in Tennessee at a nuclear facility last year that got quite a bit of attention. And of course, modernized is the acceptable term in Washington, but it's it has a connotation of something advancing and progressing towards somewhere better. And in fact, of course, this is a barbaric playing with the lives of every living thing on Earth to make nukes, quote unquote, more usable. On top of which, you have U.S.-Russia relations arguably at a worse point than ever, even in the previous Cold War, during which the two militaries talked to each other, and now they no longer do. And you have these tensions between the United States and North Korea as well. So we are at a point where the danger is as high as it's ever been and growing. And unless we end nuclear weaponry, which will probably require ending reliance on warfare as foreign policy, our luck will run out sooner or later.
Lily, I wonder in some ways, and one thing I think about this issue, I feel similar to this issue in some ways in the way people relate to it as I feel about climate change, in the sense that in some ways, like global catastrophe can be kind of difficult to wrap your head around. And I think also vis-a-vis nuclear weapons, certainly, I'm 31, certainly the way I was sort of taught in school coming up was that was like a problem of your teacher's generation. That was like their problem. That's not really your problem, so don't even worry about it. I don't even think I learned anything relevant in school about the impact of nuclear weapons on humans, although my father did tell me a great, not great story, but a telling story of being in Hiroshima not that long after the bombing, and you could still see the shadows of people on walls that have been vaporized. So that stuck with me. But nevertheless, you don't learn anything about it. That perhaps this is an issue where people have been to some degree, I don't want to say they're not paying attention. I think there's more attention on it now than there has been in some times, but still desensitized to the potential impact of it.
No, I think that's true. I mean, the idea of world-ending weaponry is, it's easy to imagine, but it's hard to, I guess, wrap your head around when there's so many other things happening in the world today. So I think, I think this issue is more on people's radars now under Trump as president than it has been in the past. But yeah, I mean, the public is, and especially our politicians and our elected officials, are largely asleep at the wheel when it comes to protecting us from the nuclear threat.
Yeah, I mean, David, I think we talked about this in over the years in several different contexts, but it does kind of feel like it's an area where I don't know if more education needs to be done, but I do feel as if like people don't, I forget the stat now, I'm forgetting the stat, but I once quoted a stat off of like the small number of nuclear weapons, I got it off Global Zero's website, that you would need to create like a total global nuclear famine. And it was like a very small number, 10. And I just was, even I, and I'm, you know, whatever, I know something about these issues. I was shocked. And I said, man, I wonder if more people knew this, it might change their attitude. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being Pollyannish here. Your thoughts, David?
I think that it is definitely worth trying. That is, getting more people to know that and telling it to them over and over again so it's, you know, present in their minds. You know, so it's good that this is a radio show. A nuclear winter can be created by a very small number of nuclear weapons, and a nuclear winter impacts the Earth and creates starvation by blacking out the sun and killing off the crops. So when Lindsey Graham says, let's have a war over in Korea and thousands of people will die there rather than here, when, of course, my preference would be for no thousands of people to die anywhere, you know, he's lost his mind, because when you're playing with nuclear war, the people are not going to die in some isolated, identified location as if that would make it okay and legal and moral. This is something where you've got the reality, the understanding that you're playing with the death of the planet and all living things on it. And then you've got the policy where what's acceptable and normal and reasonable is actually, you know, patently insane. You had a commander of the U.S. Navy in the Pacific a couple of weeks ago asked, if Trump tells you to nuke China, will you do it? And he said, well, yes, of course, we must obey orders. You know, the world would go to hell if we didn't obey orders, even, you know, orders that destroy the world. And illegal orders that you have an obligation not to comply with. And you contrast that with Jeremy Corbyn, the head of the Labour Party in the UK and the next prime minister, if current trends continue, who said, no, I would never use nuclear weapons, and was widely denounced for being so unreasonable. I mean, what a, you know, an anarchist threat to security and stability for suggesting that he would never blow up the earth.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more, David. And I'd also like to add, just thinking about why more people aren't up in arms about this threat. You know, the nuclear system was designed to keep people out of it. This is a system that is designed to put the power in the hands of a few, mostly men, who make all the decisions. And from our entire education, we're taught as citizens that we don't have to worry about it. There's nothing we can do about it. So I think while a lot of people are actually concerned about the nuclear threat and are awake to the fact that, as David had said, the chances of nuclear accidents, miscalculations, or intentional war are higher than they have been since the height of the Cold War, people don't feel like there's anything they can do about it. Mm-hmm. But we know at Global Zero, and David knows at World Beyond War, that's just not true, that we have to build up the grassroots movement and hold our elected officials' feet to the fire when it comes to being accountable to the nuclear threat.
Well, we are going to put a pin in it there, take a break, come back with more with both of these guests on this issue here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here on the, well, sort of in between the official dates of this year, the 72nd anniversary of the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the U.S. government. And we continue to be joined by David Swanson of World Beyond War and Lillian Daigle from Global Zero. And, you know, David, one of the things I was thinking about in preparing for this, and I think relevant to people's thoughts about the possibility of nuclear war today, is the what I view certainly as sort of the obfuscation around, you know, why they actually dropped the atomic bomb in the first place. And I think that, you know, when it seems like, well, it's the only something that people would do in like the most dire of circumstances to prevent even more death, it's easier to believe, well, this would never happen. But when you see like it was a political decision, then I think it's a lot easier to say, well, this easily could happen again. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the history is indisputable. You know, all of the top generals in the United States said it was not needed before it was done and after it was done. It was not needed to compel Japan to surrender, to end the war, to save lives. It was, of course, the taking of hundreds of thousands of lives, which the president proceeded very quickly to lie to the public about, call Hiroshima a military base, and so forth. To drop a bomb to demonstrate something, you don't have to drop it on a city. To make the point, you don't have to drop two bombs, unless you're trying to test out two different types of bombs, on two different cities. And of course, we have the records of Truman referring in his diary to the telegram from the Jap emperor, as he called him, asking for peace. The Americans were well aware that Japan was ready to surrender, wanted only to keep its emperor, which the United States would not tolerate until after having dropped the bombs. But you can go through the well-known names from Eisenhower to Leahy, that, you know, all the top U.S. military officials said, no, it's not needed, you know, and yet Americans are still taught in the United States, in schools, in films, in documentaries, in news broadcasts and newspaper articles. They're taught this myth that somehow it was a humanitarian thing. Somehow it prevented more evil than it caused to drop nuclear bombs on cities, which, you know, is just contrary to reality.
Yeah, it's a weird moral relativism. Whenever people say that to me, I always think of you know, the things your mom always says, two wrongs don't make a right. I'm also glad you referenced that Truman quote. There's no president that skates more on, like, all the crazy racist statements in his, like, diaries, whatever, but that's a whole other story for another time about Harry Truman. But, you know, Lily, the other thing that I think that sort of just gets elided in history is the impact of nuclear weapons testing, both then and now, certainly. But, I mean, here we are couple generations beyond some of the testing in, say, southwest of the United States, and they're still lingering, you know, I don't want to say too much about it. Talk about it if you could, because I think that's something that no one really touches on.
Nope, no one touches on that, and no one touches on the impacts of nuclear weapons plants and storage facilities as well. Mm-hmm. The legacy of nuclear weapons testing is horrific and underreported, in my opinion, and in many others. Many communities, mostly Native in the Southwest, are sick, who can't drink their water, et cetera, from, you know, nuclear testing in what used to be indigenous land. I actually just read a Teen Vogue article, of all things, a couple weeks ago about the Marshallese and how, you know, the United States forced these Marshallese off their native islands and atoll in the South Pacific, bombed it to hell. And then now these people who had to flee to another low-lying island are being forced to relocate again because of a lack of action on climate change. Mm-hmm. So the impacts of nuclear testing, whether it be in the southwest of the United States, the Marshall Islands, Kazakhstan, Africa, they're serious and they're not being addressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Teen Vogue definitely evidenced that the youth, especially the young women, are much more radical than I think perhaps many people in D.C. would care to think. But I think it raises another question, what Lily was just saying, David, and I think this maybe is a question for making anything relevant at any time, but drawing those links between various different struggles and things that people care about. I mean, I'd say there's probably many more people who care about environmental racism than nuclear weapons. And when you show people it's easy to combine those two things, you know, you've got a whole other constituency to start advocating for stuff.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, it's interesting. Pew did a survey of 38 countries last week or the week before and, you know, asked about every important danger and threat from the United States to Russia to China to ISIS to climate change to cyber attacks, you know, but just didn't mention nuclear apocalypse unless they actually asked and nobody said they cared about it, which would be even more depressing. But I strongly suspect they just didn't bring it up. It isn't thought about. You know, we have believers and deniers on the climate threat, you know, with the believers, you know, living in a fact-based world. But we have, you know, pretty much the entire political establishment and communication system denying the urgency of addressing the growing risk of nuclear apocalypse. And, you know, it's crazy to me because neither threat seems acceptable to me, neither climate destruction nor nuclear destruction. You know, I was part of a press event at the National Press Club this morning that was on C-SPAN saying, let's get U.S. planes out of the skies in Syria. Syria, not just because they're making everything worse in Syria and killing lots of people, but because we are risking a military confrontation between the United States and Russia, which is risking nuclear war. This matters, you know, and it's just not talked about in Washington, D.C.
I think it's a good question. Let me ask you this follow-up too, David. I mean, I don't know. I'm very hesitant, as I'm sure you know, to give any credit to Barack Obama for any range of things. But I have to say, it's been shocking to me to see how few Democrats especially seem to have any care at all for the Iran deal, for Obama's slight restraint in Ukraine that I think probably pulled it back from the brink there, and just issues where obviously there are, I think you could say Northeast Asia too, although he didn't really do much of anything. But, you know, obviously there was at least some sense that, like, okay, at a certain point, we better slow this thing down or it's going to get really bad. And it just seems like that has just completely gone out of the window here with this new sanctions bill, this new attempt to push, you know, weapons into Ukraine. It seems very, very nerve-wracking for me.
Well, you know, I give Obama credit for not having been even worse than he was on Iran or Ukraine or Syria or any number of other places, just as I give Trump credit for announcing that he will stop arming anti-Assad forces and fighting for overthrow in Syria. While I condemn both of them for their outrageous policies, you know, which are absolutely intolerable, as are those of, you know, most other governments around the world. But on nuclear weapons, you know, Obama was understood to be an opponent of nuclear weapons while, you know, giving speeches that falsely claimed war had been with us since the first man and falsely suggested it was hopeless to get rid of nuclear weapons until some future lifetime and falsely claimed that nuclear weapons had something to do with defense when, in fact, a wealthy, militarized state like the United States gets absolutely nothing defensive out of nuclear weapons. And all the big nuclear powers have lost wars to non-nuclear powers while possessing nuclear weapons, which also don't, you know, do anything to deter non-state terrorists. So, you know, you contrast that with Trump, who says nothing about getting rid of nuclear weapons and seems more inclined to use them if somebody annoys him on the spur of the moment. But both of them have continued, initiated and continued the same policy of building more nuclear weapons, investing massively in more nuclear weapons, leading the nuclear arms race around the world rather than leading a reverse arms race as is needed. So, you know, not a lot of applause for either of these characters from me.
You know, Lily, you were in the thick of it in the Iran deal. It was obviously, it kind of feels like it was 85 years ago now at this stage in the game, but relatively recently. I mean, what's changed from then and now? I mean, it was difficult to get the ball over the goal line there, but I mean, it's just even people who were allegedly, ostensibly in favor of it seem to not care at all on Capitol Hill about just ripping it up.
Right. So progressive foreign policy does not equate to progressive Democrats. So foreign policy is just an issue that is almost the same when it comes to Republicans and Democrats, in my opinion. And the nuclear status quo reigns in both parties. So the Iran deal was a grassroots victory through and through. It never would have passed if it weren't for the tens of thousands of people who rallied, who called their members of Congress and forced them to do the right vote on that. You know, so I think now that grassroots movement has unfortunately dissipated. I hope it resurges again if this deal is threatened, which it looks like it's going to be by the Trump administration. But yeah, I mean, we need to get progressive foreign policy back on the radar of the Democratic Party and to, you know, whatever Republicans will take it.
I mean, I might already know the answer to this before I ask it. Are there people on Capitol Hill that have some level of sanity on this issue that, you know, you all are engaging with?
Absolutely. There are a handful. So Senator Markey and Representative Ted Lieu introduced a bill into Congress this session that would essentially restrict Donald Trump and any other president's authority to unilaterally launch a nuclear weapon. So in this bill, you know, if the United States wanted to do a first strike, the president would need to get a declaration of war by Congress in order to launch a nuclear first strike. It would significantly reduce the risk of Donald Trump erratically making a decision, which he's legally entitled to do, and legally no one's allowed to stop him. So this would prevent something like that from happening. So Global Zero and 18 other organizations delivered 500,000 petitions to Congress a couple months ago and had a press conference with Senator Markey, Ted Lieu, Barbara Lee, Representative Jayapal, and a few other folks. So we do have some champions in Congress, but not enough.
In safe areas. No doubt about that, hearing that. You know, David, I know that you're active on a lot of peace and justice issues. I'm curious what your thoughts are on Ted Lieu. I don't know much about him, but I keep seeing his name pop up on Yemen. Now I'm hearing about nuclear weapons. I keep seeing his name pop up there. I mean, is he something of an anti-war figure in the Barbara Lee mold? Where does he stand?
Oh, they all have good and bad points, you know, and I don't think we should, you know, focus on trying to identify which ones are the angels and which ones are the devils, because none of them are either. You know, they all have good positions on good bills and horrible positions on horrible bills. But I would criticize severely both Lieu and Lee for their hawkishness on building up a new Cold War with Russia, while praising both of them for their important steps on pushing back on nuclear first strike by a president. And on wars in Yemen and Syria and elsewhere. I've never met the man in my life, but I thank him for his good positions and wish he had a good position on everything.
Yeah, well, one day we'll be able to start talking about that person, hopefully. But I'm curious, Lily, I mean, obviously this time I'm sure of the year is very busy for you all. There's a lot of things that I'm sure are certainly happening. I know at least tonight in D.C. at about 10 o'clock, there's going to be a candlelight vigil at the White House at 10:02, which was the time that the bomb was dropped, I believe, on the 9th. So I say that to say I know that there's a lot going on now. You know, moving forward, and obviously there's not just one thing, so I don't want to, like, pigeonhole you on, like, this is the strategy to get there. But what are some of the things that, you know, from your perspective, from people you're talking to, from your organizers on the ground, that you all want to do to try to get this, you know, push this issue?
It's our analysis that any federal victories under President Trump are null and void, just not going to happen. So we're really excited to get hyper-focused on local organizing across the country and to recruit and build up, train activists in their communities to start holding their elected officials' feet to the fire. I mean, it's not like we're helpless on this issue. It's just that our elected officials aren't doing anything about it. So we're going to be encouraging our activists across the country to be passing local city council resolutions, declaring that no president should have sole authority to launch a nuclear weapon and that we shouldn't be dumping $1 trillion into our nuclear arsenal. We're also going to be encouraging folks to start holding their members of Congress's feet to the fire and really asking them, where do they stand when it comes to nuclear weapons? Are they with us? Are they against us? And we hope that by, you know, some really solid bird dogging and some good power building in local communities, we can start gaining more champions in Congress. And with a kind of dual strategy of people power and political power, we'll be able to make an impact in the 2018 and 2020 elections so that whoever is our next president is going to have to take some substantial actions when it comes to nuclear weapons.
Let me ask you this follow-up. Well, one random point of information and then a follow-up question. Tacoma Park, Maryland, just outside of D.C., was that the first ever city to be like a nuclear-free zone in the 80s, or am I mistaken?
I believe so. David probably knows a little bit better than me, but I'm fairly positive if it was the first, if not.
Is that something that you guys think about? I mean, like, it's sort of, and I think some people might say, well, that's a little bit abstract, you know, like Tacoma Park or whatever. Peoria doesn't control nuclear weapons, but building that kind of groundswell, you know what I'm saying? And is that sort of really the goal of a lot of those kind of actions?
I think so, definitely. You'd also be really surprised about, you know, nuclear weapons crossing through different communities. A lot of nuclear weapons in the United States are actually shipped around on semi-trucks, just driven on open highway. So it's extremely concerning. There have been a lot of safety violations. I think recently a driver was caught drunk driving a nuclear weapon. But that's besides the point. But yes, I mean, creating a local groundswell and having people take back the power and really feel their ownership over this issue, I think is key for us getting it back on the agenda.
Well, David, as you know well, I mean, this used to be one of the biggest movements in America. You mentioned some of your friends at the outset of the show who are doing some civil disobedience. How important is raising the prominence of those type of actions going to be here to pushing it back into people's consciousness?
Well, I think putting out the lack of any actual guarding or securing of these things is critical to making that protection happen. But, you know, we need to get to the point of dismantling and doing away with these weapons, not just protecting and guarding them well. And beyond that, you know, Gorbachev says if the United States continues dominating the rest of the world with non-nuclear weapons, these little countries like North Korea are never going to give up their nukes, which they see as protecting them. So we actually have to scale back the whole war-making enterprise. You know, I think a good step for a locality now, beyond declaring itself a nuclear-free zone, is to declare itself in support of the nuclear weapons ban treaty that most nations on Earth are backing, and urge the U.S. federal government to sign on to that. I mean, this helps the campaigns to divest money from nuclear weapons by increasing the understanding that they are illegal. So, you know, this is something we'll be talking about at an upcoming conference. If people go to worldbeyondwar.org, they'll see a conference we're planning and a flotilla on kayaks to the Pentagon that we're planning, which may be even more fun than sitting in a conference.
I might have to get out there and paddle a little bit. Lily, about 30 seconds. Anything you want to leave folks with here?
You know, just that the people have the power in this situation, and I think it's time that we rise up and grab it.
What's the Global Zero website?
Global Zero website is www.globalzero.org.
Ah, see, you got the right URL there at some point. Anyway, I appreciate you both. David Swanson, World Beyond War. Lillian Daigle from Global Zero. You guys do great work, and I hope everyone looks up both organizations. And that's where we're going to have to leave it on this note here. We're going to come back more with more after this break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about generals in the White House and some about the quote-unquote deep state, and also in relationship to that, a little bit about the new documents that have been released around the JFK assassination. And we are very happy to be joined again for this segment by Jefferson Morley, who's the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Alternet. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us again.
Good to be here, Eugene.
So I wanted to start with this issue of the generals around Trump. Now a number of former generals in sort of pole position here in a lot of these White House offices traditionally held by civilians. Are you at all troubled by the proliferation of flag officers around the president here?
Yeah, in two ways. I think that it's an important development. And first, understand it's an unprecedented development to have so many generals in senior positions, especially ones that are traditionally held by civilians as part of the tradition that civilians should be ultimately in control of the military. And so with a Defense Department and National Security Council headed by generals, you really don't have that notion of civilian control over the military. So that's one concern. And the second concern is that I think what we're seeing is, you know, the Trump presidency is not really like other presidencies and is in a lot of ways much weaker than traditional presidency. A president like Obama or President Bush used a wide range of tools to achieve their ends. Extensive liaison with Congress, regular meetings with different constituencies in the government and outside of the government. Trump is really ignores all of that and is really pretty much a media president. And what we see in these military officers advancing is that they are filling a power vacuum that is around the Trump presidency because Trump is not using all the levers of power like a president. And so this military expertise comes into play, and it's really the only form of expertise that Trump himself trusts. He's very anti-intellectual. So somebody from the traditional professions, the people who usually lead the government from law, from business. I mean, Trump is really only comfortable with business and military leadership. And in particular, as time goes on, with only with military leadership, because the only business people he trusts are the business people in his own family. And so what you wind up, what we now have is we have these senior positions held by people with only one form of expertise, military expertise. And that is a very limited form of expertise when you're dealing with all the issues facing the Pentagon. We're facing the National Security Council. You know, you need to have regional expertise in Europe, in Iran, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia. A military guy just isn't going to have that kind of experience. He's not going to know those issues. He's not going to know about nonproliferation or climate change or hunger or migration patterns or arms trafficking or human trafficking. And so not only are we getting a government run by military officers, but military officers necessarily have this very limited expertise. So we're kind of, I'm concerned on both grounds. It's a disturbing trend for both of those reasons.
I'm curious how you feel about the Democrats' reaction to John Kelly becoming chief of staff. It's somewhat similar, I think, to when McMaster came in. But I noticed that Richard Blumenthal and Nancy Pelosi were essentially sort of speaking, sort of saying, well, this seems to be a hedge against chaos, sort of paraphrasing what they were saying. And I was a little surprised with that. I thought they were taking sort of an easy point to attack Trump. I mean, is that also an issue that it seems that sort of in a bipartisan fashion, people seem to view these military figures as like, oh, well, this means at the very least stability?
Well, I think that reaction is very sensible and to be expected. I mean, it's better to have somebody like Kelly than to have Trump. I mean, Kelly's not an idiot. Kelly doesn't lie constantly. Kelly has some experience outside, you know, the bubble of a family-owned business in New York. So I don't criticize Democrats for welcoming some semblance of normalcy. That's only to the good. I mean, it's complicated. It's not an unmitigated good, but it's better than, having a jackass like Reince Priebus there, you know. And in the Trump era, you know, you have to take small things when you get them. So I'm not crazy about the idea of a general running the White House staff. The last time we had that was Alexander Haig under Richard Nixon. And we saw the deficiencies of military leadership from him, a kind of overbearing authoritarianism, rigid mentality. And we run all those same risks with Kelly. But is Kelly better than Reince Priebus? Yeah. So I'll take small favors when we can get them.
You know, I've seen some discussion on the internet. I don't know if I see it as actually not that significant at all, but I'm curious your thoughts about, I guess, Steve Bannon is the guy who originally introduced John Kelly to Donald Trump. So some folks sort of saying, well, perhaps this is a strengthening of Steve Bannon in some ways to have Kelly move forward here. I think it's probably just, you know, rich, famous people all kind of know each other and introduce each other to each other. But I'm curious if you see any real significance in the fact that that was, I guess, the initial personal connection between Trump and Kelly.
I've seen that same story. I think Trump likes a guy in a uniform. And so I think that's the basis of the appeal. Does Kelly share Bannon's politics? You know, I don't know. I don't think that this is a huge plus for Steve Bannon.
You know, I'm curious in relationship to sort of this concept here, you know, these military guys coming in, filling a void. And I know you've written a lot about this because, you know, so much is going on behind the scenes. I mean, do you think this has any connection or no connection at all to all these leaks and other things? I mean, it seems, I'm speculating, but at least what seems to be a coordinated campaign by somebody in the intelligence community against Trump. Any connection between maybe these military moves and those folks, or do you think it's two separate phenomena?
I think it's separate. I mean, first of all, if you look at these leaks and you look at the stories that they're in, the leaks are coming from all over. The leaks are coming from inside the White House. Leaks are coming from clerical people. The leaks are coming from people in the Justice Department. They're coming from people in the intelligence agencies. There's not one source of Washington leaks. That's a fantasy that conspiracy theorists put out there. Everybody leaks because that's the way factions do battle in Washington. And we have a multiplicity of leaks supporting the moves of a multiplicity of factions. And those don't come from one place. So I think there is a faction in the intelligence community led by John Brennan, which is very opposed to Trump, is appalled by his ignorance, by his hostility to the CIA, by his hostility to the very idea of intelligence. But I don't think all the leaks come from the Brennan faction by any means. And I don't think that Kelly owes his ascension to the Brennan faction. He Brennan and James Clapper and some of the other former CIA directors, they're trying to discredit and delegitimize Trump as for the purpose of getting rid of him, for the purpose of ending his presidency. John Kelly took his job for the purpose of rehabilitating and rescuing Trump's presidency. So they don't; those two factions don't have, they have some things in common, but they don't have a lot in common.
You know, I'm curious what you made of Jeff Sessions' and I guess Dan Coates' the press conference around the leakers situation there. I mean, two things I'm particularly curious about. I've asked a couple people this. One, I mean, do you really think there are way more leaks now than there ever have been in Washington? I thought that was an interesting statement. But two, it seemed as if the potential to increase at least potential prosecutions of journalists, I mean, that was sort of shocking to me and quite chilling, but I'm curious your thoughts about that.
I don't think there's a whole lot more leaking going on now than used to. There is a little bit more because the Trump team is so undisciplined and Trump is such a poor manager that he can't control the backing in the White House from among his own people. And so a lot of leaks are coming from there, and Trump has only himself to blame for that. Is there more leaking coming from the intelligence community? Maybe. I mean, because we're in this unprecedented situation where it seems that the Russians had a very organized covert effort to intervene in our election, concern to the intelligence community. So that's on that point, that's my reaction. You know, I think Sessions is just flat out trying to intimidate the press. They can't control the leaks, so they'll try and control them by fear. It's not going to work. We'll see if they prosecute journalists. You know, the Obama administration went after a lot of journalists. And so Trump might follow that precedent. But I don't think that people are going to be intimidated by this administration. Its credibility and popularity are very low. The tools that journalists have to fight back are considerable. So it's a threat, and it's a real threat. It's disturbing that, you know, it's come to that, and it's getting worse and worse, the intolerance and the authoritarianism of the administration. We'll have to see what happens. You are right. It was a disturbing sign.
You know, I'm curious, you know, here we are in August. We're, you know, relatively deep here into Trump's first year. I think we've seen quite a bit. I always wonder sort of like, and I think this is a big debate that people are having right now, how to sort of view Trump's role in this whole thing. I mean, is he more of kind of like an impressionable blank slate that people are jockeying to influence? Is there some sort of coherent policy agenda beneath what he's doing? I mean, it seems kind of like he's just moving from day to day and that he has sort of these general beliefs, but they're not deeply moored in anything. So he's just really, he's kind of easily moved from sort of point A to point B, you know, based on how people are able to appeal, you know, to those sort of general feelings they know he has.
Yeah. He's very undisciplined. He's a lazy man. So you know, you notice you don't see any sustained effort around, you know, what were supposed to be his signature policy issues. You know, he was going to have a $1 trillion infrastructure jobs program. I mean, he spent about 5 minutes, you know, he devoted 1 week to it and then abandoned it. And so you don't have much discipline or follow through on the agenda. So I think what you're seeing is that the Republican Congress will pass the Republican agenda, but they will not pass the Trump agenda. And, you know, that's costing him because people realize that he's not really an asset to the Republican Party in terms of getting things done legislatively. He has a free hand with executive power and appointments and regulations, but he's really accomplished nothing significant legislatively. And it looks like he's not going to, or we will see. But the signs are not good. And that goes back to his laziness and his lack of discipline.
You know, all this talk about the deep state flying around just seems so apropos that now we have new documents coming out about the JFK assassination. Sort of the biggest storyline that's been coming out of this is this article that was on Politico, I think it was by Larry Sabato, about the CIA having doubts, or subsequently after the Warren Commission having doubts about the quote-unquote official story of the assassination of JFK, sort of soft pointing the finger back at the Castro brothers and so on and so forth. I was curious what you thought about that piece, which seemed to be getting around quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the notion that the CIA came to have doubts about the official story, I mean, the thing you need to understand is the CIA was the source of the official story, at least when it came to the identity and the actions of the assassin. So what Phil Shannon and Larry Sabato were talking about is in the mid-1970s, in 1975, the official story came under attack because it was clearly false. The CIA had not told the Warren Commission about the plots to kill Castro, which were going on at the very moment Kennedy was killed, and they had not told the truth about what the CIA knew about Oswald before the assassination. So the CIA didn't have doubts about the official story in the 1970s. The CIA had to figure out how it was going to respond to massive public disbelief in the official story. And I've written about this on my blog, jfkfacts.org, and I'm going to write some more about it. What the documents show is not that the CIA had official doubts or that the finger points back at Cuba, but that the CIA was caught in a series of lies, which are actually documented in the new JFK files. And this is what I'm going to be writing about how they duped the official investigation, how they misled and covered up both the plots to kill Castro and the CIA's association with Oswald. So the stories within that Politico piece puts out, and that's what I'm going to be writing about in JFK Facts. And I also tell the story at greater length in my forthcoming biography of James Angleton, one of the key CIA figures in the JFK cover-up. And that book, The Ghost, will be coming out in October. So I'm covering this story, and there's a lot there. But it's complicated, and I think that this initial take from Politico is, doesn't really do justice to what's out there. I think it's wrong.
Yeah, no, well, certainly wouldn't be the first time Politico had been accused of that. But no, certainly, and I've got my pre-order in for The Ghost. I hope other people do as well. But I'll admit I'm a bit of a junkie on this kind of thing. I mean, reading the story, I've always just felt, I don't want to get too deep into it, and I know you're writing about it, so I don't want to bury the lead here. But I've always just felt this sort of, the CIA relationship to Oswald and him going through the Soviet bloc countries and ending up back in America. Something about that story, the sort of traditional story and the way it's told that he was some sort of, you know, foreign agent. Just, I don't know. That story just seems very fishy to me.
Well, it is very suspicious. And it's particularly suspicious because when Oswald was arrested for killing the president and then was killed in police custody and people began to investigate, the CIA, through James Angleton, completely hid and concealed what they knew about Oswald for the 4 years before the assassination. And for those 4 years, Oswald was a very well-known commodity to Angleton and other top CIA officers. And all of that was hidden from the American people and for more than a decade. If it had been known at the time, in 1964, the Warren Commission investigation would have been totally different. Top CIA officials, including Angleton, would have lost their jobs because their performance, even putting the best face on it, was completely atrocious and resulted in an unprecedented breakdown in presidential security. So it was a very significant cover-up perpetrated in 1963 and 1964. And look, 54 years later, we still can't see the picture clearly, right? This information is just coming onto the public record now. So it was a very effective cover-up and had a profound influence on America.
No, absolutely. You know, I'm always curious in these sorts of situations, I always think that is one of the reasons maybe why the Warren sort of commission story stays so strong is that it's difficult for Americans to really think, man, the U.S. government, some portion of it, the CIA, whoever it was, that someone might have been motivated to do something so heinous inside U.S. borders.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. It goes to your fundamental sort of perception of reality. And for a lot of people, the notion that a faction in the U.S. government would ambush a sitting president for the sake of, advancing their policy views. It's just, it's very difficult to imagine. And so the Warren Commission story is quite comforting. It's like you don't have to worry about something so terrible happening because it was one man who killed him for no reason. So let's just move along and don't worry about it. But if you take the story seriously and you look at it, it's clearly possible that Oswald was manipulated by by people in the CIA for the purpose of a political assassination. And all of the cover-up and all of the lying that has gone on around it only further, you know, enhance that suspicion. So, you know, for a lot of people, it's unthinkable. And for other people, it's common sense. You know, when people vie for power, they resort to violence to prevail. It happens in every society. And why couldn't it happen in the United States? So, but it does go to our most fundamental beliefs. And the Warren Commission story retains the allegiance of a minority of people. And I think part of that, a small part of that, is because it's comforting. It's more comforting in an emotional way than it is persuasive in a logical way, because the evidence for it is, let's say, shaky.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I appreciate it. Again, that's Jeff Morley. He's the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Alternate. Pre-order The Ghost, a new biography about James Angleton that he is putting out in October. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.